This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Border security is of increasing concern under the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. He's enacting several policies that encourage illegal immigration and make enforcing the law more difficult. Some states are actually suing the Biden administration because of the devastating effects these policies are having on states. We're going to start today's program with a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this subject. Then an interesting story from the world of religion. The World Evangelical Alliance, the world's biggest organization of evangelicals, has a new leader, a German man with close ties to the Roman Catholic Church. His selection as the leader of this organization shows a certain level of comfort with efforts to unify evangelicals with Rome. What makes this man's selection even more interesting is his close association with the church formerly known as the Worldwide Church of God. We'll have a conversation about this with the author of an article being prepared for the Trumpet with this provocative title, Will the Former WCG Unite with Rome? Trumpet writer Josue Michels. We'll talk about that. In our third segment, we will discuss an underappreciated way to protect yourself from coronavirus. If you want to increase your resistance to COVID-19, you can do more than just wash your hands and wear a mask. We'll talk to personal trainer Jorg Mardian about an aspect of protecting yourself that, in my view, we don't hear nearly enough about, and that is exercise. Then we'll finish the program with a last word about the fact that there actually is a wrong way to obey God. We'll talk about how to make sure you're obeying God the right way. But we'll start by hearing about the latest in America's border crisis prompted by the pro-immigration policies of President Biden in this report from Andrew Miller.
Two American states are suing the Biden administration for enacting new immigration policies to dramatically reduce the number of illegal immigrants eligible for deportation. Both Arizona and Montana argue that these new policies will have devastating consequences. On March 8th, Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovic amended an existing Texas lawsuit challenging attempts to put a 100-day moratorium on deportations. He amended it to also challenge the Biden administration's efforts to only deport three types of illegals: those who have crossed the border since November, those who pose a threat to national security, and those who commit aggravated felonies. The attorney general said, "If asked about the poorest policy choices I've seen in government, this would be a strong contender. Blindly releasing thousands of people, including convicted criminals and those who may be spreading COVID-19 into our states, is both unconscionable and a violation of federal law. This must be stopped now to avoid a dangerous humanitarian crisis for the migrants and the people of Arizona." Montana Attorney General Austin Knudsen also joined the Arizona lawsuit, saying, "Meth trafficked into Montana by Mexican drug cartels has wrecked our state. The problem will only be made worse if the Biden administration continues to allow criminals to stay in the country. Enforcing our immigration laws and helping to keep Americans safe is one of the federal government's most important functions." Now, Biden administration officials argue that their new policies do not explicitly prevent anyone from being deported, but rather just prioritize the deportation of the most dangerous illegal aliens. But field officers making arrests outside the three specified types of illegal aliens would need approval from their superiors, meaning that far fewer illegal immigrants will be arrested in the first place. And many progressive Democrats admit that the real goal is to abolish border security altogether. Thousands of illegal migrants are marching into the United States, anticipating that they will never be deported. Nearly 100,000 migrants were apprehended at the border in February, compared to only 78,000 the month before. And according to the New York Post, thousands of illegal immigrants, many of them COVID-19 positive, are being set free across the country as the crisis on the southern border escalates. In fact, so many illegal aliens are crossing the border that the Department of Homeland Security is asking that its staff volunteer to go on medicine runs, do housework, and make meals for the illegal immigrants being apprehended. Representative Dan Crenshaw of Texas noted that there were over 6,000 illegal migrants apprehended at just one station. And one Yale University study has estimated that there are already roughly 22 million illegal aliens in the United States, and the Biden administration's new policies could encourage millions more to come. In a series of executive orders issued in February, Joe Biden brought back catch-and-release practices that allow aliens caught at the border to be released into America until their court date. He ended President Donald Trump's policy of making Central American asylum seekers stay in Mexico until their court hearings. He issued new regulations that limit the ability of Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents to track down illegal aliens eligible for deportation. And he made a proclamation ending construction on the border wall. American political analyst Samuel Huntington has argued that out-of-control Hispanic immigration actually poses an existential threat to the United States. A failure to adopt American culture could balkanize the nation while creating a split between a Spanish-speaking United States and an English-speaking United States. And while the Anglo-Protestant peoples who settled America's 13 original colonies were largely descended from ancient Israel, the Hispanic peoples of Latin America come from a part of the world steeped in the culture of the Holy Roman Empire. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry explained in Where America's Race Riots Are Leading that America's border crisis was actually prophesied. He wrote that illegal aliens are pouring over the nation's southern border by the tens of thousands, but our leaders refuse to stop the flow. Then he cited a prophecy of Moses from Deuteronomy 28, saying that, "But it shall come to pass, if you will not hearken unto the voice of the Lord your God, to observe all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. The Lord shall bring a nation against you from afar, from the ends of the earth, as swift as an eagle flies, a nation whose tongue you shall not understand. And he will besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trust. Throughout all your land you shall be besieged in thy gates throughout all your land which the Lord your God has given you." So this reference to Israel's high and fenced walls coming down is a prophecy about open borders where foreigners flood into the land uninhibited. Currently, the foreigners flooding across America's border are mainly from Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico. But other Bible prophecies, such as the one in Isaiah 10, show that enemies from Europe will soon join their ranks. A future Trump administration may tighten up America's border security once again, but the current open-bordered policies being pushed in America are sowing the seeds for the nation's downfall.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. The Trump administration made quite a big promise about shutting down the flow of illegal immigration, campaigning on building the wall. That was a huge promise that that Donald Trump made to get into office. And there are a lot of people that look at his record on that and they say it wasn't nearly as strong as he had promised it would be, and he didn't finish the wall. What happened with illegal immigration into the United States during the 4 years of the Trump administration?
Yeah, that definitely was a big struggle for the Trump administration, because like you said, that really, in some ways, that was kind of like his signature promise during his 2016 campaign, is to build a wall. And then when he first took office, there was all sorts of almost like a hysteria coming from the Democrats that like, children were going to be rounded up in the middle of the night and sent to drug-plagued parts of Mexico immediately. And none of that actually happened. I mean, he did make progress on a border fence, and he did end the some of the catch-and-release policies to where, like, people were actually asylum seekers from Central America actually had to wait in Mexico till their court date instead of just coming here, being released into society, and then never showing up for the court date. And so he did make some progress there, but the illegal immigration Like you look at the numbers, and the numbers are hard to always determine because you're basically looking at immigrants apprehended versus immigrants deported. If you get across and don't get caught, you're under the radar. You don't show up in the statistics.
Yeah.
And so some of it you'll be like, oh, well, the because like immigrants apprehended did actually go up under the Trump administration. Some would claim that, oh, well, I guess there's more coming here. That's why they're apprehending more. But it's also possible you could just be doing a better job at catching the ones coming across. But yeah, the number that apprehended after several years of Trump did go down. And it seems to be that, like, as like word spread throughout Mexico and Central America that people were being deported, fewer people came, which is actually one of the main benefits of strict border enforcement, as it does discourage people from coming illegally in the first place. That's why we're seeing this big border surge now, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others have been talking about abolishing border enforcement entirely. And so with an entire wing of the Democratic Party talking like that, as soon as Trump left office, like I said, the number of immigrants apprehended in a month has gone from 78,000 in January to 100,000 in February. So that's like a 20-something percent spike of people, like I mentioned in the report, are coming here because they who may not have come before because they've heard the new administration is going to be more lax than the old.
Any more specifics about the kind of effects that some of these Biden-era policies would have? Like you mentioned specifically, say, the catch and release, where you're allowing people to await court dates within the United States, and there are so few of the immigrants under that policy who actually show up for their court dates. So it's effectively allowing a huge percentage of those individuals free access into the United States. Any other specifics that, say, these states that are suing the Biden administration are saying this will be devastating to us? Why is that?
Right. And well, and a lot of what the Biden administration's done so far is just a return to what it was like under the Obama administration. Plus, you have the additional measure on top of that. Like, you do have the AOC wing of the party talking about, like, abolishing border administration completely, which encourages more to come. But in terms of the specifics, because this lawsuit these states are making is that originally the Biden administration talked about putting a 100-day moratorium on deportations. I mean, like, don't deport anybody for 3 months. And then, well, the state of Texas sued them for that, and they got that shut down. But then Arizona and Montana have jumped on the bandwagon on another part of that law, that where they said that, well, we're going to prioritize deporting those who've arrived after November, those who are have committed felonies, and those who are threats to national security. Which originally, if you don't think about it too much, doesn't sound too bad. You're like, well, if you only have so much federal resources, you can't deport everybody immediately. And so by prioritizing, like, the felons and the national security threat, sounds like a good thing. But before they made that law, the vote is like, you were just trying to deport or determine whether you should deport anyone who came here illegally. Now, by making those three priorities, in effect, what it has is you can't arrest or deport anyone who doesn't fall into one of those three categories without approval from your superiors. And the superiors are the type of people who aren't approving those deporting. So you're instead of prioritizing it, it really comes down to, like, okay, well, we're only deporting convicted felons and national security threats, which there's quite a bit of illegal activity, including, like, sexual crimes that you can get up to without actually getting a felony charge on your record. And so there could be quite a few criminals that come here and then basically will never be deported because they haven't been done something so bad that they've been labeled a convicted felon or a national security threat.
There's obviously a lot of ideas about this and opinions. I'd just like to get yours. What is motivating the Biden administration for making these kinds of pro-immigration policies?
Well, when you do a little digging, and it's actually been a little bit of time since I've looked into this, because some of them there is just a natural dispute between the parties on how strict we should be on border administration for humanitarian reasons. But there is, especially like some of these people, you start looking at those who worked in the Obama administration with maybe connections to the Communist Party USA or some of these other far left groups. And some of those, if you like trace back to like the activists, that there was like basically an intellectual thought of like transforming America into a socialist state by basically bringing in foreigners to do the jobs that Americans won't do. In this case, the job that Americans won't do being voting for socialist candidates. It's basically changing the electorate. And I've seen some of like communist philosophers, even American communist philosophers from the 60s be a little bit more honest about that, that they're like, well, if we can't get the American people to vote for such and such a policy and such a candidate, the Guatemalans will. Mm. And so we just need to get as many Guatemalans into the or other people from Latin American socialist countries into the nation as possible. And so there definitely is a, I don't know how big it is, but a segment of the Democratic Party that I believe thinks that way.
Well, the effects on the nation certainly are not positive, and the prophecies that you pointed to show us that they're going to get a whole lot worse. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Andrew. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about President Biden's pro-immigration policies. He's written an article titled "Biden Administration Opens America's Southern Border." You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The world's largest organization of evangelical Christians now has a new leader. His name is Thomas Schirmacher, and there are a few things about him that are unusual and notable. He's German, and he has strong links with the Roman Catholic Church. He also has close links with the church formerly known as the Worldwide Church of God, which was the parent church of the organization that sponsors Trumpet Radio. Now, this brings up some very interesting questions, and to talk about this, we have the author of an article that should appear sometime soon at thetrumpet.com with the provocative title, "Will the Former WCG Unite with Rome?" Trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Thanks for having me again.
It's good to have you, and this is a very interesting subject here. First of all, if you wouldn't mind, tell us about the World Evangelical Alliance.
Yes, the alliance Thomas Schirmacher is now heading is an alliance of more than 600 million evangelicals. So evangelicals have quite a few different organizations and national organizations and different churches, but under this organization, they all are united to give them in the world and in politics a stronger voice.
So this new Secretary General, what makes him such an unusual choice to head the World Evangelical Alliance?
Well, I have been watching him for quite a few years, and the first time I saw him was that he had a meeting with Pope Francis, which was quite unusual for an evangelical, and he got a lot of criticism for that. And it's also interesting because he is headed from Germany, and in Germany there are around 1.5 million evangelicals, so there are not many evangelicals in Germany, considering the population is mostly Catholic and Protestant. Most evangelicals are in the US and in other parts of the world. So it's interesting that he came into that type of a position just from the background he has.
And tell us about his, just how closely, you mentioned that he had an audience with Pope Francis, his ties with the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes, he is said to be the closest evangelical friend Pope Francis has, and he meets him quite often on just casual conversation, but also on big issues like they consider their take on family very important, how people try to distort the views on family and how important it is to strengthen the doctrines together in that sense. So they are very different from Protestants to take that stance a little bit more liberal. So they have quite a few meetings on that, but also on the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. They see that quite a few churches are attacked and church buildings are destroyed in the Middle East, and they want to cooperate together with that. Now, that's quite unusual for an evangelical to cooperate with the Pope. Quite a few evangelical movements see the Pope as the Antichrist, as someone that seeks to destroy all the evangelical movements. So, but he is saying, no, the Pope is our friend in many issues. I don't want to undermine the doctrines we have as evangelicals that are very unique, but I do want to cooperate with Pope Francis on quite a few issues that we have in common. And as I said, he gets a lot of criticism for that, but also quite a few think that's the right way to do it to further Christian unity around the world.
So I do think the Pope being willing to have audience with someone like this, it does fit maybe a broader trend that you see the Catholic Church seeking to extend ties into the Protestant world. And we've talked about, and we'll talk more about even in this interview, Catholic Church's efforts to draw back those Protestant daughters, the way that it's written in Bible prophecy. What, from having studied Thomas Schirmacher and just the kind of man he is, what do you believe is motivating him seeking that kind of cooperation with the Pope, in spite of some of the criticisms that the evangelical movement would have for that?
Yes, I think it's power. Power is one of the big issues that many Protestants and many evangelicals lack. They don't have that power in geopolitics. They don't have the power to influence governments. They don't have the power to spread their version of Christianity around the world, just like the Catholic Church has. And evangelicals have been more at a fringe for a long time, especially in Europe. They are being looked down as a kind of outcast often because no one wants to cooperate with them, and they are out of the mainstream. They are not cooperating with the Catholic Church. They are not cooperating with the other Protestants. So they're a little bit pressured there to say, why don't you cooperate with the other Christians? Don't you believe all in the same God? Can't you agree on more of the same things to really tackle the big issues that the world is facing? So I think some of that pressure is motivating him to conform more with the Catholic Church and work with them together.
So the fact that the World Evangelical Alliance actually put this man at the head of the organization, it shows that there is, despite maybe some criticism of his ties with Rome among rank and file evangelicals, there's clearly some appetite for this kind of reconciliation on the part of the elites within that organization. Maybe you could just talk about the broader trend of these efforts to reconcile Catholics with Protestants in Europe and more broadly.
Yes. Thomas Schumann has been the assistant general secretary of that organization, so his ideas have been long known. And we can see that especially the elite, as you said, want that reconciliation, even though some of the members in the different churches are very strictly opposed to it. And the Catholic Church has been working to unite its daughter churches, as they are called, back into its government. But for various reasons, this hasn't worked. One of them is the child abuse scandal that has been a huge deal for many to point to the Catholic Church, and that has been led to many of the schisms. And there are other issues where they just reject the authority of the Pope. But all those issues are not very much differences in doctrines. In many doctrines, they actually agree on things. So the Catholic Church is willing to compromise on a few things and say, like, we are working on this issue, we are working on that issue. Why can't we just all work together for the benefit of the Christians around the world?
So even though there is some, there are certainly hurdles to cross, the reason why we're so interested in this, as I alluded to earlier, Herbert W. Armstrong talked about prophecies in the Bible that specifically describe this reconciliation between Catholics and Protestants. And you have to view what's happening here and the efforts at reconciliation in the context of those prophecies. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, Mr. Armstrong made some very, very strong statements back already early into his ministry, and again very specifically in 1963, where he said that the Protestant churches and the Orthodox schism will be healed, basically that those churches will be reunited under the Pope's authority once more. And he based that on a prophecy in Isaiah 47 that speaks specifically about this trend. And in the Bible, a church is often symbolized as a woman. In Isaiah 47, it talks about a very powerful woman. And in verse 8, it's quoted saying, "I am and none else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children." So that's a specific prophetic language where the Catholic Church says it doesn't tolerate any other Christian group that doesn't submit to its authority. Now, we have seen many religious wars in the past where the Catholic Church has tried to force Protestant churches back under its authority. In recent years, this has been more peaceful, but as our Trumpet Editor-in-Chief, Jeff Louis, noted, we can also expect this to be more violent in the future.
So, Mr. Armstrong talked about these prophecies. After he died, the successors in that church, the Worldwide Church of God, departed from his teachings, and they began to move the church much more closely to mainstream Protestant teaching. They certainly abandoned any of the prophecies about the Catholic Church and understanding of the Catholic Church that Mr. Armstrong had taught. So now you have this interesting situation where the church that was the Worldwide Church of God is aligning itself with these evangelicals, and they are actually a part of this World Evangelical Alliance, correct?
Yes.
And so you have these associations, everything that we were talking about with the direction that Thomas Schirmacher is taking that organization, the Worldwide Church of God, or what was once the Worldwide Church of God, is part of that movement now.
Yes, and that's probably one of the greatest shame of all of this. The prophecies that should point us to the fact that the Worldwide Church of God under Mr. Armstrong understood the Bible like no other organization out there, that were following God and his government. And they were showing where the Catholic Church is heading and where other religions are heading. And he was pointing often, again and again, to Revelation 12, verse 9, where it says that even the whole world is deceived by Satan. And he said again and again, this includes the religious world. But many in the Worldwide Church of God didn't want to accept that. They wanted to become more like the world. And they see it as a great success to join an organization like the World Evangelical Alliance that is more accepted by the world, that is more accepted by the mainstream Christianity. And Thomas Schirmacher is said to have helped the Worldwide Church of God in Germany to join that alliance. So he has very strong connections to the Worldwide Church of God, now called Grace Community International. He even wrote a book in 2000 that is entitled "A Sect Becomes Evangelical, the Reformation of the Worldwide Church of God, a Study." So he wrote that book in German that basically shows like how the Worldwide Church of God became evangelical and was formerly a fringe group. But Mr. Armstrong was strong that the Worldwide Church of God should never join the religious movements of this world, because he understood the prophecies that would speak of this end time, that they will again ally with the Catholic Church, like the Holy Roman Empire has suppressed other religions previously.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize this point, that this man, Thomas Schiermacher, is that his associations, not just with the Pope, as we've been talking about, but he's been closely allied with the Worldwide Church of God, or Grace Communion International, as it's now called. And this is part of the reason why you've kept such a close eye on this man, is he's actually, well, maybe you could just tell us about some of, you said he wrote a book about him, but he's actually preached at GCI services and has very close ties with them.
Yes, just recently we had a member in Germany that came out of the Worldwide Church of God, and I approached him and asked him if he knows Thomas Schiermacher, because I was just interested in that. And he said, yes, of course, he was here in our congregation and he preached to us. So that was quite amazing to me, and also a little bit scary, because I knew that he was so close to the Roman Catholic Church. And Trump Editor in Chief Jeff Lewis said, this Roman Catholic Church is actually designed to persecute God's true church, as he explained in his book about the true history of God's true church. So we have the Catholic Church, we have Thomas Schiermacher, and we have the Worldwide Church of God called Grace Community International. And Thomas Schiermacher is essentially a bridge between the two. And I think that's one of the most scary parts of all of this.
Well, it's difficult to say exactly how this is going to unfold, but I think you've put all of these pieces together in seeing this man who has the background that he has, the religious interests that he has, both in Rome and in the Worldwide Church of God, and just an extraordinary picture of just how far the former Worldwide Church of God has departed from its teachings from before. And in a sense, you could see people who are part of that organization having to make a choice here. If that organization does align itself any more with the Roman Catholic Church than it already has, that's about as far of a departure from what they understood at one point from the Bible as you could possibly get. It's very interesting to see how this is all unfolding, and I guess we'll see what happens from here. But we definitely appreciate you reporting on that. We've been talking to trumpet writer Josue Michels about the new head of the World Evangelical Alliance, Thomas Schiermacher. And Josue is working on an article about this, the title of it, Will the Former WCG Unite with Rome? Watch for that at thetrumpet.com. Josue, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Exercise is good for you. People who exercise tend to have fuller, healthier lives, protection from disease, better recovery from illness, longer life. Well, now research is showing that these benefits may even extend to protection from COVID-19. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
So you're in the business of helping people exercise, but I understand you're entering another coronavirus shutdown. So if there's benefits to exercise, I guess the government doesn't see it that way, huh?
That's right. Exercise, the gyms and the studios seem to be the first to be shut down, no matter how much we ask them or tell them that there is a clear-cut benefit to, you know, just the respiratory aspect, getting oxygen into the body and that, but they don't seem to agree with us.
Well, let's talk about that. It's been said that exercise is medicine. You're obviously in that business, so you have pretty strong opinions about that. What does that mean, exercise is medicine?
Well, exercise is medicine. Really, it's exactly what it means. It has a medicinal effect upon the body, and the government recognizes that when it wants to. So the action of the physical activity is really about doing something that moves the body, with the end point being to change the physical function of the body. You're doing something better. You're making it better. So if we dig into the benefits, we find that exercise is far-reaching, and it affects all the parts of the body, from the immune system to the brain to the individual energy system within the cellular structure itself. I mean, it's quite fascinating. And the goal is to think of exercise as medicine, so it's a therapy that can be prescribed in specific doses for specific needs. And doctors will actually prescribe medicine and say, hey, you need to move to get healthier. So now that way of thinking can be a benefit to the current viral landscape that we're in. So at the moment, there's so many people with pre-existing conditions, and that's coupled with old age. And those are major reasons for these premature coronavirus deaths. And then now, here we're in a lockdown again, and so being immobilized, people are in hospitals, people have home bed rest, people have a lack of physical activity due to lockups. If you add that to the mix, that can really hinder the ability of the organs to resist the coronavirus infection. So I would say exercise gives us some specific abilities to counteract the biggest side effects of the coronavirus.
So what are the main benefits, would you say, talking about coronavirus specifically, how can exercise help you to resist that?
Right. Well, there's hundreds and hundreds of benefits. I'm just going to talk about four of the big ones right now. So the first one is, research tells us that if we exercise, you show a reduced risk of what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. And that's one of the more lethal complications of this coronavirus. So ARDS is a disease where you get lung tissue injury, inflammation, and respiratory failure. The CDC says that up to 42% of patients that are hospitalized for COVID-19 will develop ARDS.
Wow.
And about half of those will die. So it's not a small issue. Unsurprisingly, it happens more with people who don't exercise. And so they have reduced lung capacity, as well as older people. So the second benefit is it ramps up production of what's called extracellular superoxide dismutase. Now that's an antioxidant, and that targets the free radicals in the body, and it protects the body's tissue from disease. So basically, in a nutshell, it enables an infected person to more effectively endure the coronavirus. So as we exercise, we ramp up production of this antioxidant, and it gives us protection.
And is that over, you're talking about someone who is in the habit of exercising has that benefit, or someone who's actually infected with coronavirus, if they exercise, that they would gain that benefit?
Well, you'll gain that benefit exercising. We just want to be, I want to make sure to say that you can't just exercise and say, I have 100% protection. It doesn't work like that. And there's no way to prove that. But if you exercise and you help your body, say with this antioxidant, and you ramp that up, being in this business for over 20 years, I would say, yes, that's definitely going to help you in at least in the recovery aspect. Because it's a virus and anybody can catch a virus. It's how the body deals with a virus. And then and that gets us to the third point of the immune system. You know, depending on the exercise that you do, the intensity and the duration, you immediately have circulating white blood cells that increase by 50 to 400%. And that's immediate. Now, these white blood cells, as you're exercising, they increase and they kill infected cells in the upper respiratory tract and the lungs. And that's where the COVID hits us the hardest. So, and as well, another wonderful aspect of the immunity is that it develops antibodies. And that likely provides some reinfection protection further down the road. And the fourth big gun of exercise, the way that it helps us, is heart health. Based on what we know today, elderly people with coronary heart disease or high blood pressure, they're increasingly susceptible to coronavirus. So data from Wuhan, China, it shows us that there's a 10.5% death rate among people that have those symptoms. So, but there's good news. So if you exercise, you help lower blood pressure and you prevent hypertension. It's not immediate, of course, it takes time. But as you keep exercising, you remove one of the risk factors for developing more severe symptoms, again, of the virus. So, and that's been shown in study after study. So basically, the healthier you are as you keep exercising, the better it is for you. And then so jump on that exercise bandwagon and start reaping the benefits over time.
That's a lot of benefits. That's a pretty strong medicine against this, it sounds like. But you mentioned the, I guess, the intensity and the duration of the exercise, that if basically you're prescribing this as medicine for this virus in particular, what are the specifics that you would recommend for someone in terms of dosage?
Right. So we really do want to tell people to, at the beginning, at least, to get into some kind of aerobic exercises, because that benefits the lungs, and as well as some resistance training. So evidence shows that 150 minutes of moderate activity, they say less than an hour, is a good initial target for everybody. And that's a great start for people. So you want to at least get the aerobic component and the strength component in. And then if you're able to include some high intensity interval training as well, really work those lungs. That's really important in fighting this virus. And then from the 150 minutes on, just increase that as you're able to, as your time allows.
And this is 150 minutes per week, per day?
Per week, yes.
Okay.
That to me is a beginning stage, you know. We have a lot of minutes in a week, so we need to fill those up each day. An hour a day is 5 days a week at least, is a great way to exercise. If you can't, just do what your body allows or your time allows. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is consistency. If you don't have consistency, like I said, it's not going to benefit you, because the benefits are transitory. So that really means you're going to see steady improvements if you put in continual time and effort to maintain those benefits. Mm-hmm. So you can't do a week and say, I'm good to go. If you haven't exercised a lot in the past, you know, start with walking, jogging, swimming, riding a bike. Anything helps. If you're recovering from coronavirus, now you're in more of a fragile state, so an exercise routine is absolutely going to help you with recovery. But you have to do it in a stepwise approach. That means don't bite off more than you can chew early on. You know, just go as you are able to.
What would you recommend the kinds of resistance training that someone might start if they're not accustomed to doing that type of thing? Where would you start them?
Well, resistance training, if you have not done anything, I would say just go, you know, you can go to a gym and you can ask somebody with knowledge, or you can go and ask a trainer. A lot of people come to me and say, just show me what to do and I'll do it at home, which is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, you need some weights, maybe a small exercise ball, a stepper. At home you can do it. And then you just need to find out how to lift those weights safely. And that's the key part, because if you're going to do it by yourself and guess at it, you might hurt yourself. So it might always be good to take an hour, spend some money with a trainer and say, teach me, put something on paper, and then I can do that at home. Mm-hmm. And that's a safe way to do it. Or you can do it at the gym as well.
Well, it's good advice. Any final words for anyone that is looking to protect themselves from coronavirus and looking at exercise as the medicine that might help them?
Right. So from all my experience over the years, I can say for certain that without a regular pattern of exercise, you're going to get frail in time. And that's going to eventually blur into some type of disease pattern. exercise is actually crucial to our life. So none of this says that we're not going to become infected. We can exercise a lot, but surely it's going to dampen the heavy viral symptoms, and it's going to accelerate the recovery time if we're exercising consistently. So that should be fantastic news to get more active, get more consistent, stay motivated, and just make consistent fitness a priority, knowing it's good for you.
I really wish that with all of the time that the news media spend on coronavirus, that we heard more of this type of message. We spoke last month about nutrition and the role that nutrition can play. We'll put a link to that interview in our show notes for today's program. Here we're talking about exercise. These are proactive steps that people can take to mitigate the effects of coronavirus in your own life, rather than just talking about staying away from other people entirely or shutting your life down, closing businesses, wearing a mask over your face, taking proactive steps that improve your immunity and improve your health and increase your resistance to these to the virus and the problems that it causes really is a much healthier way to go about it. We appreciate that very much. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about the role that exercise can play in protecting you from coronavirus and recovery from it if you do happen to get it. He's working on an article about this that you will find at thetrumpet.com soon. We thank you very much for your time, Jörg.
My pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
Did you know that Satan obeys God? Maybe you've never thought about this, but God is more powerful than the devil, so when God commands, Satan complies. When God wanted to free the Israelites from Egypt, Pharaoh repeatedly refused, but God hit him with so many terrible curses that he finally gave in. Pharaoh was a type of the devil. In the book of Job, Satan appeared before God to accuse this righteous man. He said, "Have you not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side?" The devil wanted to bring Job down, but he couldn't cross the boundary God had placed. God told Satan, "Do what you will, but don't harm Job himself." God chose to redraw that boundary to test and develop Job's character, and Satan charged right up to the borderline. He destroyed almost everything Job possessed, but he didn't cross it. Then he pressed God, hungry to attack even harder. God responded, "Behold, he is in your hand, but save his life." And so again, God commanded, "This far and no farther." Satan struck this poor man with boils from foot to crown, but he obeyed God. He didn't kill Job. Satan has zero mercy. He's full of hate. He's eager to unleash misery. He has no self-restraint. The only thing that restrains him is God. He is unable to defy his maker. In Matthew 4, Jesus Christ commanded, "Be gone, Satan," and the devil left him. In Revelation 12, verses 9 through 12, God cast Satan and his demons out of heaven. He confined them to earth, and they complied. The devil obeys God, and he completely hates God. Now, this tells you something very important, something worth thinking about. Obedience to God is not enough. Maybe you obey God, but examine the quality of your obedience. A lot of people are perfectly willing to do things they shouldn't do if nobody's watching. They'll work with the boss around and they'll loaf when he's gone. They'll obey grudgingly because they know they might get thumped if they don't. A lot of people would commit crimes if they knew they wouldn't get caught. But from his children, God wants a different kind of obedience. Now, it's true, there are times where God does demand submission, as he did with Satan. Within a family, God commands parents to punish children for disobedience as a means of establishing obedience as a habit. But, you know, that's only a starting point for the right kind of obedience to God. Psalm 111 and verse 10 says, "The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do his commandments," or all they that obey God. Now, this is talking about more than just fear of punishment for breaking a law. When it says the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom, it's talking about respect and reverence for the lawmaker. This is proper fear that leads to maturity and wisdom. Obedience to righteous law produces understanding, and that reinforces respect for the lawgiver. The more you obey God's law, the more you'll understand it. And the more you understand God's law, the more you come to love it. That love inspires the kind of obedience that God is really looking for. In Ephesians 6, verses 5 and 6, the Apostle Paul tells workers to obey your bosses, but not just any old way. He specifically says, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. In other words, obey your boss as if he were Jesus Christ himself, and do it sincerely, wholeheartedly. That is the obedience God wants. Mere obedience doesn't necessarily make you any better than the devil. The question is, what is happening in your heart? Romans 6 and verse 17 praises those who obey from the heart. God wants you to practice that kind of obedience toward the authorities in your life as a means of developing that toward Him. Do you obey God out of obligation or out of love? Examine your motives and train your heart to want to obey, to please God. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 12 says, "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Eternal your God, to walk in all his ways," or to obey him, "and to love him, and to serve the Eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul." So there's a progression here in this verse. Godly fear leads to obedience, and that leads to love, which inspires you to commit to a life of eternal service in God's family. God doesn't want grudging, Satan-like obedience. He wants joyful, heartfelt obedience from his loving children. He wants us to love his way of life the same way that he does. Psalm 119, verse 97 says, "Oh, how love I thy law." Learn to love God's law, love the Sabbath, the holy days, and tithing, and all of God's laws. Get to the point where if someone told you, "You don't have to keep the Sabbath anymore," that would sound just as ridiculous as, "Well, you don't have to enjoy your favorite food anymore." Love that law. That love is what motivated Jesus Christ to obey his Father, even to the point of torture and death. This depth of love and obedience is not something that you can work up yourself. You have to pray that God will help you by the power of His Holy Spirit working with you. But the more you love God and His way, the harder you'll strive to obey Him because you want to. And soon you'll be able to work together with God to teach the whole world to keep that beautiful God family law of love. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Josue Michels, and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Marilyn Jansen. "There are no limits to our opportunities. Most of us see only a small portion of what is possible. We create opportunities by seeing the possibilities and having the persistence to act upon them. We must always remember opportunities are always here, but we must look for them." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.